And you know what I heard over the weekend? Someone leaned into my ear. A birdie often tells me these things. And they say, Ivan, you know all that crack about the voting and the voting for each other and voter fraud in the Dáil chamber? I tell you what, Ivan, would you ever look into this fob card? And I said, what fob card are you talking about? Well, a lot of things have changed since my day, 02 in the Dáil. Apparently now TDs have to swipe in and swipe out to get their expenses. And you know what someone suggested to me? That the irregularities for the voting might be in the halfpenny place with people getting other people to swipe them in. So just two questions. A, why do you have to swipe in? Is it just TDs around Dublin? Secondly, what is the system? Because we know what the voter thing, but for the CCTV, everyone would have denied it. I'm going to follow that up. Apparently, it was said to me, you can't get your expenses unless you sign in, and it mightn't be out of order for someone else that you wouldn't get caught if someone else swiped your fob. I will go and endeavour to find out. Of course, it wouldn't possibly be true. I know that. All right.
I mean, take, for instance, you know, the one-stop misogynist shop. We'll take, you know, rap and hip-hop.
Eminem.
Like, I mean, well, Eminem, I mean, he's the classic. I mean, you know, Eminem's,
Like the bitch and all the kind of aggressive stuff against women.
Well, I mean, yeah, his real Slim Shady album, which was 1997. I mean, I actually went through it to see, could I actually pull out a couple of lyrics to show you? And I just was looking at them going, I can't read this out. You know, this is way before the watershed. I mean, there's a lot of offensive stuff. And yet he still sold, you know, he is still sold today something like 220 million records.
I'm fairly contemporary, yeah.
I mean, the guy is huge, even though he's completely dogged by this misogyny.
Is it your point that some people get away with it, or...?
Well, I think that, you know, there are some songs that when you look at them now, you know, and you look back, and much more recent songs, and you kind of go, my God. I mean, we'll take something like, you know, Every Breath You Take, right? The Police song from the 1980s. You know, when you actually look at the lyrics of that, you know, oh, can't you see you belong to me? I mean, it's the ultimate stalker song. You know, if you look at it like that, I mean, I've always found that song creepy. So, you know, do you kind of get him to, you know, do you get Sting to go in and rewrite the lyric? Take the other, you know, controversial classic that actually caused an outcry from the day it was released, which, of course, is the song sung by the Crystals, And Then He Hit Me, and It Felt Like a Kiss is the name of the song. And this was produced by Phil Spector, of course, you know, now, you know, a future convicted murderer. And it was actually co-written by Carole King, who has since sort of expressed regret that she wrote the song, because, you know, it's essentially that sort of, you know, it's about domestic violence, but it's, you know, it's very misogynistic.
But Lisa, you are a feminist, and yeah. I mean, like, the fact of the matter is, you could say Baby It's Cold Outside has undertones of date rape about it.
Absolutely, and I have absolutely no problem with John Legend rewriting it. Now, I think having the Vanity Fair magazine actually printed some of the rewritten lyrics, and, you know, aesthetically they're a bit clunky. I mean, you have, you know, I think it's sort of, what will my friends think, Clarkson, who she's duetting with, Kelly Clarkson, and the response is, I think they should rejoice, and she comes back with, if I have one more drink, before he replies, it's your body and your choice. I mean, just aesthetically, it's pretty damn clunky. But, you know, and I have no problem with that being rewritten for a generation that find it, you know, are uneasy with the original. But I think, you know, don't damn the original for what it is. It was written of a time, it meant something different at the time. It was written in the 1940s. It was written in 1944, you know, but, you know, this whole PC thing, I mean, you know, where do you stop? I mean, I've heard people object to the Band-Aid song, which is written in 1984, which, because it says, you know, nothing ever grows, no, you know, no rain or whatever, or river, no trees or river flows, you know, and people say, well, I mean, you know, it does rain in Africa and trees do grow and they are happy, you know, and people have damned the sort of that lyric. So, you know, where do you sort of draw the line between being politically, you know, correct? I mean, should Band-Aid rewrite the song that raised, you know, millions for Ethiopia? You know, it's a fraught area.
Because you take something that looks like harmless fun, like Grease and Summer Lovin'. Did she put up a fight?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's problematic.
Kinda,
that is problematic. And I think a lot of people who hum along to songs unthinkingly,
but not to be banned by EU law.
What's the difference between UKIP and the Brexit Party?
Well, UKIP turned rather rotten. And I think Nigel Farage wanted something completely different. He wanted a party that was broad-based, had a good reputation, and could start again from where UKIP ended up. But if you mean, do both parties want us to be free of the EU, then the obvious answer is yes, of course they do.
I suppose what I was hinting at was the constitutional, the way the Brexit Party is comprised, it is in fact a company whereby people buy shares in it, isn't it? It's not quite like a normal party. And does that give Nigel Farage himself more control?
Well, obviously, you know, we are only 6 months old. I mean, that is the reality of it. And we are not, in the course of just 6 months, going to be able to do all that we have managed to do if we're obsessed and navel-gazing about setting up structures. And all that will come in due course. At the moment, we're focused on one thing. Get Britain out of the EU and deliver on the people's vote. Honour the referendum. That is what we are about. We can worry about structures and all the rest of it at a later stage.
Now, you were enormously successful in the European elections. I don't know what proportion or the number of MEPs, but people like yourself that won in that election, will you be available to stand as MPs?
Certainly, I am willing to do so. And I'm already a prospective candidate. It is up to the party in the end, when the actual crunch comes, who they are fielding and who they are not.
And can I ask you, as a seasoned observer, right, you're a candidate and you're rowing your own party and individual boat, but as a seasoned observer, you've seen many PMs come and go. A lot of people say with Boris that, you know, he sets out a stall, he'd be dead in the ditch if he didn't get a deal, he'd definitely go for no deal, he wouldn't throw the DUP under the bus, all things that he has this kind of ambidextrous, kind of fleet of foot ability to kind of change position and say, well, what problem? No problem. Do you think that a central issue, in the same way he'd probably be a great campaigner, that Theresa May was seen as a cold fish and so on, do you think there is a question of trusting Boris?
Well, certainly he has broken a number of undertakings that he gave. Now, I don't hold it against him so much that he didn't make the deadline of the 31st of October, or at least we assume he hasn't. Because he was frustrated by a parliament that was quite determined that we weren't going to leave on the 31st of October. That much I understand. But he also made a lot of other statements. Things like, you know, he wasn't going to sell out Northern Ireland. Well, now we've got a border down the Irish Sea. I mean, you've identified some of them in your question. He can't always be relied on to deliver what he promises. And I think he would be much better advised to say, this is what I shall spend all my energy doing, rather than saying, I'm going to do it, do or die.
I was at today's hearing, but first, take a listen to this reading of the victim impact statement read by Anna's mother in court today. Some listeners may find this distressing, but we think it's important to hear the words that were spoken.
The happiest day of our lives was the 10th of August 2006, the day the court declared that we could become the parents of Anna, who we felt was the most wonderful child in the world. We agonised for so many years through a laborious adoption process, waiting for her, and when she came she brought to us everything that we had dreamed for all of those years, and much more. All of the love and happiness that we longed for suddenly flooded into our lives. She was wild and wonderful, electric, so full of fun, madness and laughter. We couldn't believe the happiness and joy we had found in our lives. She was the love of our lives, and every single night before she went to bed, she told us that she loved us too. Every night she came to kiss us, and she said always in French, Bonne nuit, dors bien, fais de beaux rêves, je t'aime. Good night, sleep tight, have beautiful dreams, I love you. She cannot do that anymore, and we cannot tell you how badly it hurts. On Monday, the 14th of May, 2018, Anna didn't come home. The cold fear we felt knowing she was in serious danger, knowing that something or someone prevented her from coming home to us. We knew she would never stay out without permission. She would never hurt us. The panic, the dread, the agonising wait, the hours that turned into days. We didn't know where she was or what had happened to her, but somebody did. Somebody knew. We waited and waited for our little girl to come home, but but she never did. The saddest day of our lives was the 17th of May 2018. 3 days later, we heard those dreaded words that no parent wants to hear. We are so sorry. Our precious little girl's body had been found. The depth of pain and haunting nightmares that we live with following the formal identification of Anna in such traumatic and horrific circumstances, there is no way to describe how that feels. We brought Anna to live in a safe place, where the only sounds in the morning are the doves cooing. No one could suspect the evil that lay in waiting for her. No one could anticipate the darkness that swirled in the souls of those that murdered and violated her. How could any child or even any adult imagine in their worst nightmares the danger that lay ahead? She wanted to live, but she was not permitted to do that. Our lives are destroyed by what happened to Anna. We cannot look at a group of teenage boys in the same way ever again. That cold fear hits and brings all the horror back. Imagine the terror. Imagine the pain she suffered. That will live with us all our lives. We lie awake at night thinking about the fear she felt when she realised she was going to be killed. We pace the house at night agonising about the torture she went through, the horrendous pain she suffered, the sadistic violation of her beautiful, pure and innocent body. To think that she was left to rot in that squalid hellhole for over 3 days. It is unbearable. It's inhuman. The whole family and friends suffer so terribly every day and every night.
Everybody has to be educated.
You see, Paul, the huge text response to this. People are saying that no one is condoning motorist bad behaviour, illegal behaviour, and or tighter regulation. But they feel that there's a very clear ID system for every motorist, your car plate, your driver's licence. There is no registration system for bike owners.
Indeed, but if you bring in registration and these kind of mandatory requirements, what will happen is you create more barriers for people to prevent them from cycling. We already have only like less than 250 girls cycling to school. If you create those extra barriers that people have to put on all the different special protective gear, register their bikes and all, they're not going to bother. You know, it should be simple and easy. That's what it was all about. Over in Westland Midlands Police there in England, they've seen a 50 or 20% drop in cyclist deaths because of this rule was brought in over there. So you're going to have more people coming home in the evening to their families, and which is a really important thing. And I think if this is just a minor issue, on a bigger picture, we should be going for the larger infrastructure projects, separating cyclists from trucks, from cars, and then reducing the speed. These will all create a huge benefit to everyone's safety.
I want to bring some of the texts. Mike says, if your guest goes onto the Merrion Road, you'll see cyclists braking lights with no lights back or front. I'm a pedestrian and they are scourged. No enforcement of the laws. Al says, is there going to be a law brought in to make cyclists filtering through slow moving or stationary traffic illegal? Cars have to give 1.5 metres, but they can go through gaps, taking out a wing mirror with an elbow or leaving a car with a scratch from the handlebar. David in Wicklow says, if the cyclist is on a country road where 1 metre is not possible, do you just have to sit and wait, or should the cyclist give way? I've been spat at by two cyclists recently while in traffic in my car, spat at my windscreen, and I'm still unsure why. There is an underlying level of aggression on the roads in rush hour that's dangerous for cyclists, motorists, and Jerry, as much as you might appeal for Boutros Ghali type peace between motorists and cyclists, it seems to be pretty fraught out there.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Personal. Gavin McLaughlin rejoins us. I cannot believe it, after all the controversy and fear and what happened to one of the directors, that fresh death threats have been made to directors of the Quinn Group.
Yeah, it's just awful. Another death threat delivered to the offices of the Irish News newspaper late last night. And here's John McCartan, a director of Quinn Industrial Holdings, explaining what happened.
From what we know, a letter was delivered to a newspaper office, and it warns that we have not learned our lesson from Kevin's abduction, and says that we have to resign immediately, as we were previously instructed to do, and that we have broken commitments, and generally a sort of a warning that the final or the permanent solution will be enacted on us if we don't immediately resign.
Yeah, and I've just obtained a copy of that death threat in the last few minutes. It says, "This is your last warning to resign to the directors of QIH. Obviously, you haven't learned your lesson after what happened to Kevin. If we wanted, we could have killed him very easily. We want to put on record anybody that removes signs, whether that be council employees or outside contractors, will be targeted. All of this will be brought to a conclusion very shortly." So it's just really chilling stuff being treated very seriously.
That isn't just a challenge to Quinn. That is a challenge to the PSNI and the Gardaí to resolve this once and for all. Well, joining us on the line now is Enda Brady, the Sky News special correspondent, because there has been a development in relation to the police inquiry relation to two Northern Irish men, brothers in fact, as the investigation and identity of the deaths of 39 people in the back of a lorry last week continues. Enda, what's the latest?
Good evening, Ivan. So we've had an appeal from Essex Police. This is the detective in charge of the investigation, wanting the public's help in finding two brothers from County Armagh, Ronan and Christopher Hughes. Ronan Hughes is 40 and sometimes uses the Christian name Rowan, R-O-W-A-N, but he is actually Ronan Hughes. Christopher, his brother, 34, reportedly, they both work in the haulage industry, and Essex Police say that the next steps in their investigation are that they want to find the Hughes brothers. They believe they are currently in Northern Ireland, and they say it is absolutely crucial that they track them down and speak to them.
Right. And
wearing and you will tire.
And what about the issue of youth, maturity, immaturity in relation to being, you know, people say, oh, they're very precocious, but they could be narcissistic, but it's something they could grow out of?
Oh, absolutely. And patterns of narcissism change. So, for example, I'm in my mid-40s and I'm absolutely baffled at the idea of people taking photographs of themselves and putting them on these various social media platforms. And I would see that as pure narcissism. However, we have to acknowledge there's a whole generation of people who don't see it as narcissism. They just see it as regular day-to-day life. So we need to be careful about judging other people's narcissism. But certainly the younger generation are more likely to get sucked into it because of their mode of social interaction, which is very much based on their own life story and telling their story on social media and showing pictures of themselves in all kinds of odd situations.
And a couple of texts on this. Good to know you're not at the top level. Must hurt your ego, Ivan. But I am at the top level. I don't understand that. Narcissists reckon their opinions are away goals. Again, these are quite enigmatic texts.
I understand an away goal. That's something to do with football, I believe.
Yes.
And I believe it's better to score an away goal than it is to score one in your home stadium. But that's
right.
All I know about football.
Yes, I know. So, if someone presents to you as being a fully fledged narcissist rather than just being a little bit self-absorbed, what way would you deal with it? I mean, like, do they have problems with relationships?
They do, and usually they present as being generally unhappy, and the problem might be obvious to me that they're narcissistic or have over-inflated self-worth, but it's highly unlikely to be obvious to them. So it takes a great deal of discussion and reorientation for them to realise the problem is that they are simply too self-centered, something they've probably drifted into over years or decades. So helping somebody to see that is very challenging. Usually by the time they come along, though, they have profound problems in their lives. Relationships are virtually unsustainable.
But in this day and age, it's impossible, no matter how narcissistic you are, to go through life without experiencing the brickbats of criticisms. I've only to look at the text line every time. I mean, like, even if you lack some level of self-awareness, there'll be lots of people out there. You know, it's a national sport in Ireland to be a begrudger and to pull people down a peg. So there can't be any real narcissists in Ireland.
Or alternatively, everybody is a narcissist, with some people spouting rhetoric that pulls people down all the time, and people being pulled down having to become narcissists as a form of defence against the other narcissists. Maybe we're just great big armies of narcissists at war with each other. And what this research says is that a little bit of narcissism is not necessarily a bad thing. It can help you with withstand the begrudgers and the problems that life throws at us day by day.
So, like everything else, everything in moderation?
Everything in moderation, and a touch of subclinical narcissism is apparently no harm at all.
And if someone accused you of being a narcissist, would you personally be insulted?
Not in the slightest.